You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 106, covering the week of January 29th through February 2nd, 2018. Glad to have you back in the program. Glad to be here. Before we get started, all the usual housekeeping. Please follow us on Twitter at Abbeville Institute. Like us on Facebook at Abbeville Institute. And subscribe to our YouTube page at Abbeville INST. The YouTube page in particular is great because we not only post the podcast, but we also post our previous lectures at our scholars, conferences, and summer schools. So it's a great resource. Also, go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. Give us an email address and we'll give you a free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sayles' Emancipation Hell, and you'll get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email on Saturday or Sunday. Also, don't forget we have a conference coming up February 24th, 2018 in Charleston, South Carolina. The topic is Confederate memorials or monuments and the attack on those monuments and what that means for America. A lot of great speakers. Ben Cooter Jones is our banquet speaker, but also Don Livingston, Kerry Roberts, Kirkpatrick Sayles himself, Aaron Wolf from Chronicles Magazine. So a lot of good talks. It should be a wonderful time. We'd love to see you out there. So please go ahead and do that. Also, if you go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org, at the top of the page, you'll see our Amazon Smile button. Click on that, and every time you shop at Amazon, you will help the Abbeville Institute. And of course, if you go to that particular page, at the top of the page, you'll see a button that says Support. You can click on that, and you can become a member of the Abbeville Institute for as little as $3 a month or $5 a month. $3 a month if you're a student, $5 a month if you're not a student, or you can subscribe annually, $25 for a student, or $50 if you're not a student. All of that will help us do the things we like to do, which is the website, the podcast, our conferences, and other projects we're working on. So go on out and become a member of the Abbeville Institute. Help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. Your donations are tax deductible, so think about that as well. And if you like this podcast, please rate it on iTunes, and please share it around on social media. Any help you can give us is greatly appreciated. Okay, all of that said, all the housekeeping stuff out of the way that we normally do, we had a really good week at the Abbeville Institute. In fact, we could probably spend a whole podcast talking about each one of these articles, so I'm going to try to do my best to summarize these things and cover them as in the best way possible. But we had some really interesting topics this week, and so I think that's the fun part of the Abbeville Institute. You might have a week where you have a theme, and then you might have a week where we have articles that could be an entire theme for a week, but they're so meaty, we could spend an entire podcast talking about them. So let's get started. The first article that we had was written by John Devaney, and it's entitled Sectionalism Returns. And this is an interesting topic because you're seeing in the United States, I think, I mean, you look at things that are going on like California secession or the movement for that, or you look at how there are certain individuals in New England who are talking about distinctive New England. Of course, we've always been talking about a distinctive South, and somehow that whole idea that the sections disappeared after the war, that we had a national government and a national people, that particular idea has always been strained. And of course, when you look at the election of Donald Trump in 2016, it was a nationalist type of election. People were talking about how we had an American people again. And I remember back in the 90s, a leftist historian named Arthur Schlesinger Jr., if you are familiar with any type of, he wrote the book The Age of Jackson, among other things. He was a court historian. He wrote a little book entitled The Disuniting of America, and his whole point was that multiculturalism was destroying America because it's fracturing this American nation. And that strain between sections and also people within those sections and different groups has always been there, and we just have chosen to ignore it for a long time. But what you're starting to see, and in fact, Dr. Livingston told me the other day on the phone that even Rush Limbaugh is talking about the balkanization of the United States. You're starting to see this. You're starting to see it happen to a much greater extent. And that's creating a very sectional climate. You do have a South. You do have a North. You have a West. You have a Midwest. You have a West Coast. You have a Mountain West and a West Coast. You have a Southwest. And so, and even within that, you have regions within these states. And so this whole idea of decentralization, whether it's cultural or political, is something the Abbeville Institute is very interested in. It's one of our core interests, you know, in looking at what's going on in America and how the Southern principle of decentralization fits within that. And it has to have a basis. It has to have a culture for it to work, but it's still there. And so how do we wrestle with that? How do we grasp with that? And this gets back into the power of the central authority. And so this particular piece by Dr. Devaney gets into the point that, look, sectionalism has always been there. And the government, the general government, has long been a vehicle by which states can plunder each other. And this is one of the main arguments against the Constitution, because people thought that you would have a general government that would abuse some states at the expense of the others. Now, one thing he does say here, and he's actually channeling Mel Bradford, and something I don't agree with Mel Bradford or even Dr. It's a minor disagreement, but that there wasn't a consensus on what the Constitution meant. I think that you can find one, and that consensus was at the time the Constitution was ratified, which is the only reason it was ratified, was because there was an agreement that the powers of the central authority would be limited in scope by what they said in Article 1, Section 8, that state powers were unlimited except for how they were circumscribed by Article 1, Section 10, and that the powers of the central government were restricted by what it said in Article 1, Section 8. This is what James Wilson of Pennsylvania said in his very famous State House Yard speech that everyone built on then following that particular speech. He made that speech in October of 1787, just a couple of weeks after the Constitution was signed in Philadelphia. So that was the general consensus. And when you look at the arguments against the Constitution and how the friends of the document responded to those arguments, that's generally what they were saying. Now, there were specific discussions about the powers of the executive branch and what these things mean. And of course, this was the basis of my Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution. I was getting into this particular argument. Look, this is how people said the Constitution would be implemented when it was ratified, and that's the Constitution we should go by. And there was a consensus. However, as Calhoun pointed out, as we move forward in time, what happened was exactly what the opponents of the document said would happen, and that's that certain states or certain, again, sections began plundering the other. Now, this was more pronounced in the North. Northern nationalism was, in many ways, simply Northern sectionalism, whereas Southern nationalism was something different. The South was willing to sacrifice its own interests at times for the good of the Union. That's what the general welfare meant. This is what Roger Sherman of Connecticut said it meant. And that general welfare idea had not changed since we had the Articles of Confederation, which also spoke of the general welfare of the Union. And so when you look at the Tariff of 1816, for example, which John C. Calhoun supported, it was a slight protective measure, and he supported it in the interests of the Union, even though that particular tariff might undercut and punish in some ways the South a little more than the North. And you also look at the economic nationalism of, say, James Madison. If you look at the National Republicans, which, of course, Henry Clay is the most famous National Republican, that National Republicanism was born during the Madison administration, without a doubt. You just look at his annual messages, particularly in his second term, and when he starts pushing for a central banking system, he starts pushing a National Republican agenda. Essentially, he adopted the Hamiltonianism that he had one time rejected and the spirit of nationalism. And so now, I know there's a dispute of, well, did Madison ever truly become a nationalist? And I think that he never stopped being a nationalist. It's just that during the time when he was Secretary of State, and of course in the Congress during the first Washington administration, and when Hamilton's economic program is being discussed, he was arguing that the Constitution didn't authorize those things because this is not what they ratified. It wasn't always principle that Madison opposed those things. If you go back and look at the legislative record, it's pretty clear about that. Sometimes that was pettiness that forced Madison to oppose some things. So, and Hamilton, in fact, was shocked when Madison came out against what he was doing. because he thought that he and Madison were bosom buddies. They were in line, lockstep on what they were going to do once the Constitution was ratified. This is why Hamilton lied, because he knew that once the Constitution was ratified, they could do whatever they wanted, but of course they had to get it ratified first, and so they said things at times that they didn't think that they were actually going to do once they were in office. So that's the important part of Hamiltonianism. But this whole idea that the section can play, I mean, this is what Calhoun pointed out. He said, look, what happens when you centralize authority, particularly when you create an executive branch that becomes an elected king, you have everyone scrambling for the spoils, and once they scramble for the spoils, and once they get the spoils, they're going to abuse their opponents. And this has been brought up because of the current tax bill and how there's the ability for state taxes, the deductions for that on your federal taxes, how that was taken away and how that hurts New York and New Jersey and places with very high state taxes. And, of course, it doesn't hurt a place like Texas or Florida where there's no state income tax. So, you have these states that, of course, this is sectional warfare. And so all Dr. Devaney is pointing out here is this, there's nothing new here. And he gives you historical examples, which I think are really good, and shows this, how the states would oftentimes butt heads, and therefore that would lead to a call, for example, of New England secession in 1794. The Constitution had barely been ratified, and you already have a call for New England to secede from the Union. So sectionalism is returning, and as Dr. Devaney concludes, he says, my fear is that the new sectionalism may not prevail against the continued aggrandizement of executive and federal power and influence. And he says, I do hope I am wrong, but the point is that the executive branch, this nationalism that the executive branch has created, is going to destroy that sectional government. And the reason sectional government is important is because it allows compromise, and it forces one section not to plunder the other. But if you have a powerful central authority, that sectionalism can't stop that anyway. So anyways, this is an interesting piece, and I think one that's worthy of study. Now, the next piece was a book review of Shira Davis Bowman's At the Precipice, Americans North and South During the Secession Crisis. This book came out in 2010, and the review is written by Jonathan White. This particular book is interesting because it's part of a subtle trend among some historians to be a little more even-handed when they start talking about the sectional crisis. Now, I say some historians, because at the same time, you also have a growing neo-abolitionist slave power, what they call slave power literature. You have a growing canon of that out there now that I think is becoming more dominant. The slave power is the main problem in the American history, and that this is the reason why we went to war. But then you have a book like Bowman's, where he points out that the North really didn't care about slavery that much. And this is kind of a neo-blundering generation, school of thought, because as White points out, Bowman says, the North really didn't care about ending slavery as much. And also, there were people in the South that were not monolithic on their thinking of the subject. And he gives you an example of William B. Campbell, who was the governor, former governor of Tennessee. Campbell said in 1860, quote, as a pro-slavery man, I repudiate the Southern move as unwise and impolitic, and tending to the ruin and overthrow of Negro slavery. The rights of the slaveholder cannot be maintained out of the Union so well as in it, and I fear cannot be maintained out of it at all. So he says, this idea that slavery was safer in the Union than out of it was echoed by men from Western Virginia and Southwestern Mississippi. So there was a school of thought that leaving the Union would also be dangerous, more dangerous to slavery than staying in the Union. And he said, Bowman also captures the security concerns of white Southerners. He says, Henry Clay, for example, believed that, quote, without colonization of free blacks abroad, Kentuckians will face a racial civil war that will result in the ultimate extermination or expulsion of the blacks. Bowman quotes South Carolina plantation mistress Brevard extensively as she wrote about her concerns over her security in the face of abolitionist agitation. In November of 1860, Brevard wrote, "It is dreadful to dwell on insurrections. Many an hour I have laid awake in my life thinking of our danger." Brevard was aware of the threats of poisoning and arson by slaves instigated by Northern abolitionists. On 10 December, she expressed hatred of Northern abolitionists because they wanted slaves to become, quote, assassins, the selfish and envious sons of Satan. And then he points out that there's a cottage industry, that secession was somehow undemocratic. And this is, of course, the slave power thesis, the oligarchy thesis, which there's a recent book, and I'll be reviewing it for the Institute at some point, From Oligarchy to Republicanism, and how these Southerners were not really democratic. They weren't really Republican. And so, he talks about that a little bit. Now, White does criticize the book for a couple of issues. He says the book, is not as well written as it could be. Needs a little better narrative. And he also attempts, as White says, to establish some type of moral equivalency between the North and South. By doing so, he says he underemphasizes such things as Northern anti-slavery violence and Northern acceptance and endorsement of such violence. He also doesn't really discuss the constitutional issues associated with secession and coercion, and how Lincoln didn't have any authority from the Southern governments to send in the troops and also to establish a military governor, and that wasn't that's precisely the reason, as White points out, the reason the Upper South left the Union. He doesn't also talk about sexual exploitation of the North, but the South by the North. And even though some of these secession declarations mention that. So there are some failings in the book, but the important part about the book is that it's an attempt to be a little more even-handed. Even a Goldfields, America Aflame, was an attempt to be a little more even-handed. But you see that there is a reaction to this, and that's the slave power literature. So there still is a debate, and Michael Holt has a new book out where he gets back into his main thesis of political power and how you can't look at the slave power narrative as the cause of the war. This is about political power, and the slave power narrative was simply a rhetorical attempt to enforce sectional government, which is what Dr. Devaney was talking about on Monday. Now, again, that sectional idea, how did this play out after the war is over? So we do have kind of a theme working here with sectional government and the meaning of that sectional government and how that played out after the war was over. And of course, Shotwell Press has a book by the Kennedy twins, Punished by Poverty. And this particular piece on Wednesday was actually sent over to us by Karen Stokes, who writes for the Abbeville Institute website quite a bit. She's a great historian, works at the archives there in South Carolina, and does a lot of good work. And she has a book out with Shotwell Press where it's a discussion of love letters from the war, and an interesting little book. But this particular piece she sent over saying, well, this corresponds nicely with the Kennedy twins book, and it does. And it's a speech that was actually made after the war by a former governor of Louisiana. At the time, he was governor of Louisiana, Sam Jones. This speech was made in 1943 to the Southern Farm Bureau Training School in Monroe, Louisiana, and it's entitled The Plundered South. And he gets into what's happened because of the war and how the war destroyed the South. The South was wealthy before the war, but Northern sectional interests destroyed the South. It's a wonderful little speech. And he says, he attacks Northern interests as being behind the destruction of the South and the problem of the American Union at that point. He says, quote, in a land of supposedly equal opportunity, children of the South have but a fraction of the chance for a good education as those in more fortunate sections. As proof of this, there are 4 million children in a certain section of the rural South whose parents have an aggregate income of only 2% of the nation's total. In a section of the industrial Northeast, on the other hand, there are 8 million school children whose parents have an aggregate income of 42% of the nation's total. Thus, these children have 21 times the better opportunity to get a start in life than the boys and girls of the South. Because of lower income and wealth, it requires in a given portion of the South a rate of school taxation 4 times as much per capita to give the same standards of public education as it does in a given section of the Northeast. He says the Southern laboring man gets in peacetime an average of 16 cents an hour less than the Northern brother. And even in this time of war, the United States government itself has placed its stamp of approval on a discrimination against him in certain war plants, which means 25% less to Southern labor when the cost of the raw material is the same and the product is sold to the government itself for exactly the same price. So here we have the general government plundering the South. He says that the Southern manufacturer must pay a tribute of 37% to 65% to his Northern competitor. He points out that at the present time, or just prior to the present war, the average per capita wealth of the Southern people was about one-third of that of the Northeastern states. To be exact, ours was $463 per capita. Theirs was more than $1,370 per capita. Because we have today only about one-third as much wealth per capita, it will be interesting to you to know that in 1860, the per capita wealth in the South is approximately 25% greater than that in the North. And it might be interesting to residents of Louisiana to know that the per capita wealth of this state was 72% more than the average for the North, and that Louisianans had incomes considerably higher than New Yorkers in the year 1850, and that in that year, the poorest state in the South was richer than any of the states of the North. Now, Massachusetts and Rhode Island excepted. So this is important because we ran a piece years ago, or last year, I think it was, by Bill Cawthon, that talked about this, how wealthy the South actually was. And it wasn't just slavery. It was also the average yeoman farmer in the South that was making more money than your average farmer in the North or your average industrial worker in the North. The South was a wealthy section before the war. And then he says this, for fear that some may go away wondering whether Negro slaves were included in the above statistics for 1850, let me hasten to assure you that they were. Had they not been included, the per capita wealth of the South would have been 343% of that of the North. And he says, property worth, all Northern states, $233 per person, Southern states, $806 per person. So actually, it would have gone up. It would have gone up. The value of exports has always been considered a fair indicator of economic stability. The United States Department of Commerce figures for the year 1859 show Northern exports to be about $45 million and those of the South to be $193 million, or about 4.5 times those of the North. So strong was the position of the South that the London Economist, a British commercial newspaper, made the astounding statement in 1858 that the economic life of Great Britain was controlled from New Orleans and Charleston. If you should mention these cities in British commercial circles today, they'd probably say with reverence to New Orleans, oh yes, that's the place where they staged the famous Mardi Gras. And of Charleston, they probably inquire whether he referred to South Carolina, West Virginia, or Charleston, Massachusetts. So this is important to understand how the South was made poor. This is sectional government, how the South was made poor by the war. The South was made poor by the war, not the North. The North was enriched by the war. He talks about how the South had 80% of the nation's exports and after the war, 21%. Before the war, 80%. After the war, 21%. He says in that year, New Orleans had 20% more exports than New York, while in the year 1940, the value of its exports had dropped to about 11.5% of those of New York. He says how competitively the position has been reversed is shown by the fact that in 1940, one out of every 5 citizens of Louisiana received some form of public relief, while such was practically non-existent in the South 90 years before. This is just, you could go on and on about this. And he brings up a wonderful quote from Daniel Webster. He says, Webster's political economic advisor said in 1828 about the tariff of 1828, which is the tariff of abominations. He said, quote, if the bill is adopted as amended, this bill, if adopted as amended, will keep the South and West in debt to New England the next 100 years. That is sectional government. And he goes on and on about how the South is paying tribute to the North. This is a wonderful speech, and it was not published anywhere else. So you're getting it. This speech is now online at the Abbeville Institute for the first time online. So this is the economic war that was going on even after the war was over, and it's often ignored or marginalized. So a wonderful little speech. You could take your time to read it. Because of time, I don't want to read the whole thing. I mean, we could just spend the whole podcast talking about this one particular speech and how that factors into sectionalism. And, of course, then on Thursday, we had a wonderful little piece. I'm going to briefly summarize this one. But this is something we've talked about before. The speech is, piece is called Southern Speech. It's written by Roger Cole, who and it was originally published in Southern Partisan Magazine back in the 1990s. But this is something that I think is a problem when you go out in the general population. You go look at, for example, the Disney World. They have the Hall of Presidents there, and they have nobody really talks with a Southern accent, and the founding generation, which they should. And he brings this up. He says, look, George Washington speaks with a Midwestern accent. He says the only Southern president permitted a native accent as the presentation is Andrew Jackson, who was heard threatening to hang fellow Southerners from South Carolina during the nullification crisis. So it's only permissible, he says, to sound Southern when expressing views contrary to those of most of the churlish regional contemporaries. Washington, though, had a Southern accent. Washington spoke Southern. So did Patrick Henry. So did all of these people. He says the problem is when you look at media, that's not the case. They all have Midwestern accents or They're dropped. Their Southern accent is dropped. This is problematic for a real discussion about the South and a real discussion about the Southern people. You have to have the South for what it was. You go to Williamsburg, nobody has a Southern accent, which they would have had at the time in the 18th century in colonial Williamsburg. They would have had a Southern accent, and that's because that Southern accent came out of Great Britain. And so he goes into all of these things and gives you an interesting perspective on colonial accents and regional dialects. And this is Albion Seed, which is David Hackett Fitcher, gets into that, how there were regional dialects and accents in the colonial period. The Southern accent was not created in a vacuum. It was part of an English dialect that actually Shakespeare spoke. So, Shakespeare spoke Southern, which is something that most people don't realize, but he did. And so understanding that part of it, language, accent, that means something. It's something real and tangible to hang on to in thinking about what the South means and words, the way we use words, the way we use language in our literature, in our music, things of that nature, all across the United States, not just Southerners, but, Northerners, the way they use literature and language and how those things, on the West Coast, there's a regional language and literature there. You see it anytime you have a quote, national radio or television program, and you have somebody broadcasting in from the West Coast, and they have a California style or a Pacific Northwest style to them. Absolutely. And people recognize this. They see it. And in some cases, they're okay with it. But, of course, the South just has to become the hayseeds out there. You can't be Southern because you're just called a hayseed. And I'll give you an example. There's a sports talk show I listen to every now and then out of California called the Jim Rome Show. And Jim Rome is from Los Angeles, and he sounds like it. I mean, he has the Los Angeles feel. He's proudly Californian. I mean, that's what he is. And his producer is from the Pacific Northwest. And he calls himself a Seattle hipster. And he dresses that way. His attire is completely that. And they were talking about they're in the Super Bowl this week. And they were at a Minnesota pub. And how he just didn't fit in with the people of Minnesota. Because they were kind of this you know, a frontier lumberjack culture is kind of the way they're describing it. And so they recognize there's regional and cultural differences, but yeah, that's okay for the Northwest. But, you know, and they weren't really making fun of it. They were more making fun of the hipster. But if you had said this in the South, it probably would have been a little different tone. Finally, so this is an interesting piece about language, and we all know accents and everything else, how that works, and it's okay to have an accent outside of the South, but not really, you know, in the South. And finally, the piece on Friday is entitled Killed for the Flag, and it's about Anthony Harvey, who was a black Mississippian killed. He was born in 1965. He was killed after a Confederate flag rally in July of 2015, so this is shortly after the Dylann Roof tragedy, and then, of course, the fiasco that came and how all this stuff got started at that point, you know, almost 3 years ago now. And how Anthony Harvey, who's proudly flew the Confederate flag and wrote a book entitled Why I Wave the Confederate Flag, written by a black man, he was chased down by a car full of other black men and run off the road and killed. And all because he had been at this rally and was a Confederate flag supporter. I mean, that was they had exchanged some words about that, and then run off the road. This is an interesting story, and I think one that Michael Martin points out that, you know, you can't, it's in the intolerance for anyone who flies the flag. I mean, of any race. It's interesting. You had these Antifa types out there in New Orleans not long ago. Who were attacking black people, who were defending the monuments. I mean, these people are supposedly for, you know, minorities. And then you have black Southerners standing up for these monuments and just saying, look, leave them alone. And they're attacked by white people. I mean, you can't even make this stuff up. The hypocrisy of it all is just, it's just so awful. But, I mean, this is what you had going on with this. And he also brings up another situation in Chicago where you had young patriots who were white Southern migrants from Appalachia siding with Fred Hampton, who was the chairman of the Black Panthers Party of Illinois. And Hampton was killed in 1969, but Hampton and these young patriots were actually working together to provide food and medical care for the impoverished in Chicago. And they had believed the color line. And the young patriots proudly flew the Confederate flag. And Hampton didn't care about that. He didn't care about it at all. And so this is the problem, you know, that you have where you cannot have any deviation from, you know, this very narrow view of what's acceptable in society. And, you know, you can fight for the rights of minorities while you're beating up minorities now, if you're an Antifa type. And this is the situation we're in. This is where the rhetoric that's used by the slave power people, for example, is so dangerous. And how this is a real issue in America. And so that's the sectionalism returning. It's not about reconciliation anymore. Anthony Harvey was a symbol of reconciliation. And that's the important part to get out of this. The real issue is that people don't want reconciliation. They don't want to have a North and South reconciled. They want the antagonism to continue because it allows them to divert attention away from real issues, which is plundering the South. Which is real issues of poverty and other things in the South. Real issues of economic problems. The money spent on tearing down these statues in New Orleans could have been spent on building the infrastructure of New Orleans, which is in a sad state. If that's what they really want to do. I mean, that was millions of dollars spent to remove those statues could have been better used to improve the drainage system in New Orleans, which failed. Just this last year during some heavy rains. So this is where we get to. Are these issues even real? I mean, isn't there better things to talk? Aren't there better things to talk about? And so this is all about, you know, what Paul Graham calls Confederophobia. It's a phobia. It's a mental disorder that's gripping these people who are trying to take down these monuments. And of course, killing people. attacking people who they were supposedly here to help. They're not really. They're not interested in that. It's about a political, social, and economic agenda, a cultural Marxist agenda, and frankly, a communist and fascist agenda. So we have to be aware of that. There's something underlying this. There's something undergirding all of this stuff. It's not just the monuments. That's just the low-hanging fruit in the cultural war, which we're going to get into in our discussion in February in Charleston. So we hope to see you there for that. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Until next time, good day.